I'm here to interview Dennis Holland, the retired manager of the Chincoteague Island National Wildlife Refuge. It's October 17th, 2005, and we are in our home in Oyster Bay in Chincoteague Island, Virginia. Denny, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Well, tell us about your early life and what brought you to Chincoteague, will you?
Oh, heavenly days. What brought me to Chincoteague was my job. I was, I've had a career with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and that career basically started when I was 5 years old, when my father was in it. However, that goes into too much detail. But I had a very interesting career going through a number of different national wildlife refuges, culminating at that time with a desk job in Jackson, Mississippi. I was the area supervisor for National Wildlife Refuges in Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Incidentally, a number of the refuges that were hit by Hurricane Katrina and Rita were under my jurisdiction and supervision back in the middle to late 70s. And in 1980, my predecessor here at Chincoteague, Mr. J.C. Apple, retired, and this is a job that I've wanted for many years. So I went through the competitive process of applying and was selected for the job. And I reported for duty, this is getting long-winded, on September the 21st, 1980.
And Dennis, why is it that you wanted to come to Chincoteague after you'd been in that beautiful part of the South?
Trying to manage a desk is far different from trying to manage a national wildlife refuge. There is nothing that will absolutely compare with the joys of being out on the land, playing in the dirt, or in this case, playing in the sand. So that I am not given towards the administrative end as strongly as I was to the hands-on.
What does managing a wildlife refuge mean?
It means, first and foremost, managing people. You have to manage your staff, the allocation and utilization of your staff, given to the needs of this particular station. And in this particular case, I was quite familiar with it from my job, my previous job down at Virginia Beach at Back Bay National Wildlife Refuge. And I used to come up here with Mr. Apple on a number of different occasions, and I just absolutely fell in love with the operation as well as the town. So, what do you do? Depending on the season, everything is land-based, and the management is land and water-based. Primary function here for Chincoteague, and it's based on its acquisition, reason for its acquisition was for the greater snow goose. Now, it goes back to 1943, when the land was actually acquired. So that mission has never changed. It's a migratory waterfowl function. You manage your lands and water to achieve the purposes of waterfowl and water birds. Public use is secondary to that. So you have to look at what is your objective, your primary objective being waterfowl management, and how does public use fit into it? In this case, it's a beautiful fit. The number of people that come are here for the beach, principally. And that use occurs in the summertime, during a period of time when we have almost no waterfowl use. So conflicts are very few.
Here in Chincoteague, there seems to be some confusion in people's minds about who actually runs the beach, that's Assateague, and who actually runs the National Wildlife Refuge. Could you explain that?
Be happy to, or at least try. As I said, we acquired the refuge in 1943 for purpose of managing greater snow geese or waterfowl. In 1965, the Assateague Island National Seashore legislation was enacted, which means that it came along well after we were here, 20 years, actually 22 years. But the Congress directed that the northern end of Assateague Island, that is principally the Maryland portion, be acquired for National Park Service uses. And at the same time, they recommended that the state of Maryland acquire land for a park. All of this was intended for public use, of course. And then they said also in the legislation that Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge would continue to operate as a National Wildlife Refuge, with the Park Service having some responsibility for public use on the beach. So, Park Service came in, they took over the, they bought out the old Assateague Bridge and Beach Authority, which was a separate entity that was authorized back in the 50s. And the Bridge and Beach Authority built a bridge to Assateague Island, built a road out to the beach, built a little restaurant and bathhouse out there. And the Park Service acquired all of their rights to it in 1965 and 66. So, it gets complex. The end result was that the Park Service, after much negotiation, ended up with running the beach under the Fish and Wildlife Service rules. Pure and simple. We still own the dirt.
Is it technically a memorandum of understanding between the two of you, or is it a handshake?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. A memorandum of understanding, mm-hmm. Right.
In federal government terms.
In federal government terms. And it's had some rough edges along the way, and turf was divided up, and my predecessor fought many a war trying to retain Fish and Wildlife Service authority and utilization of it, but it came down to a legal definition which was enacted by Congress in 1972, and so that act prevails government-wide, not just here, but government-wide, and it says where there are areas of dual jurisdictions, Fish and Wildlife Service interests will prevail. So that helped. Settled some of the turf.
Is it because Fish and Wildlife is the older agency?
No, it's because of wildlife requirements as opposed to people requirements. Wildlife can't change as easily as people can, and you can manage people somewhat easier than you can wildlife. So, but really, it's a matter of allocation of the space for the critters.
I want to ask you a question about the water in the main pool around which the wildlife drive mm-hmm. runs. Mm-hmm. It's very dry, been very dry this summer, and very hot, and we've had almost no water in that pool at all. It's just beginning to come back, I noticed, this morning. I have a friend who's asked why we didn't have a well, why we didn't have wells out there to put water in there for migratory wildfowl.
That's something that several of my predecessors explored as well as I did. Basically, it boils down to this. There, you can use shallow wells, but you're dealing with fresh water being lighter than salt water. So fresh water will float on top of salt water in the ground water. And when you start pumping down that, it's called a lens, when you start pumping down that lens of fresh water, then your salt water will intrude much, much more, see. All right. Or you can sink deep wells and go into the freshwater aquifer. And in order to get the quantity of water that would be needed to provide plenty of fresh water in these ponds, you also then start competing with human needs for that same fresh water. It's expensive, and it gets into some very, very sensitive areas of, here again, allocation of resources. Do you want to commit X number of millions of gallons of water strictly for wildlife use that you're pouring on top of sand, which you know is going to flow right out? And basically it boils down to a decision that so many of us could not make, which is, no, we can't do that.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Would that deep water well have tapped into the same aquifer that we draw water from here on Chincoteague?
Probably. Even though we would be located here, and the Chincoteague wells are located over on a NASA facility, probably talking about the same aquifer.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. It gets very complex.
Would you talk a little bit about what the biggest changes you've seen in the refuge and refuge management, this refuge, during your tenure there and now?
Well, the funding has greatly improved. Thank heavens, it was needed. Consequently, going along with the funding has been improvement in quality of equipment, number of employees to do more jobs. Compounding it, though, creating, shall we say, a different demand on the employee, is the age of technology and information systems. In 1983, I was named to a task force to try to come up with some list of standards by which the Fish and Wildlife Service, namely refuges, could start utilizing computers. And we came up very quickly with some, you know, beautiful list of things that we could use computers for. It took better than 20 years. Well, maybe not quite that much, but it wasn't until probably the middle 1900s, 1990s, I should say, before we started utilizing computers on a wide scale. But in doing so, it was a bigger demand on the employee himself, because everyone wanted information right now. So, do you get out and play in the dirt and do great and wonderful things for people and wildlife, or do you sit down at a desk typing on a keyboard? Where we used to have clerks and secretaries that would take dictation or take your script and type it out, stick it in the mail. 3 or 4 days later, the person would get an answer to a question they had asked 2 weeks prior. Now they want that same question answered in a matter of hours. So there's greater and greater demands on managers as well as employees' time to provide immediate answers. Are the results any better? I don't think so. It's not as much fun, though.
Denny, you told us when you came, which was in 1980, but I never asked you when you retired. What year you retired?
I left the station. I was transferred from the station in January of 1988. So I was on station from September of 80 to January of 1988, and I went into Washington as chief of the branch of resources in National Wildlife Refuges, and that was a promotion. I had been told, in fact, there had been a policy announcement right before I made that decision to go in, that while this station was eligible for an upgrade, none of the existing managers on those select stations would be eligible to receive it unless they transferred. Well, I said, okay, enough is enough, and I looked at my time remaining, which was 2 or 2.5 years, so I said, I want to get the higher grade so I can make a little bit more money in retirement because it's time to go. Make some money. So I went to Washington in January 1988, and I retired in December of 89, just before January of 89. So I was in Washington for 2 years, and then I retired. So technically I retired in Washington, although I never changed my residence from Chincoteague.
Will you tell us a little bit about the relationship with the town of Chincoteague when you were manager, and whether you think that has changed at all?
Yep. It got kind of spotty at times. In fact, it got testy a couple of times, to put it mildly. You have to kind of look at the rationale and reasons behind why our relationships could get on Rocky's edge. And it was basically a limited number of parking spaces, and here again, competition for that same space. We as an agency, were not specifically in the business of public use management, although we were the stewards of the land. Park Service was the agency that was also running the recreation out at the beach. They had a policy, and we endorsed it for a while, of every time the dunes would wash out, they would rebuild the dunes basically in the same place. And it soon became realistic to me to understand that beach dynamics were greatly at play, and it was time, instead of continuing to lose beach on the ocean side without building any on the backside. In other words, we were stopping the sand from transporting across the beach and continuing to build on the bay side. If you maintained sand dunes in one fixed place and trying to maintain a particular line, ultimately you're going to lose because the gradient, the slope of the beach, is continuing to get steeper and steeper. And when a sizable storm comes along, you have a catastrophic loss, a huge loss. And we just weren't able to maintain that anymore. We wiped out, the storms wiped out a number of parking spaces. And that translates into dollars in people's pockets here in Chincoteague. If folks can't get to the beach, all the merchants, all the motels, hotels, owners and operators hear about it. Needless to say, we did too. There was no place to build additional parking spaces, and without intruding into the wetlands. And wetlands, as you know, are critical for the survival of so many different food chains. And we would not permit that to happen. So we got crosswise with the Chamber of Commerce and a number of different people. And what is the answer to it? There is no answer to that particular question. But there was finally a tacit acceptance that we would try to maintain 1,000 parking spaces over there. And I don't know what the number is today. It probably isn't that many and will probably never be that number again. But certainly isn't easy. It's not an easy answer. Ultimately, the long-range answer is going to be a transportation system, which, boy, does that get into problems.
Now, what do you mean by that?
A bus, a tram, or something of that sort. You can accommodate a huge number of people.
On the beach?
On the beach.
Uh-huh.
But what you can't accommodate is a huge number of automobiles.
And that beach continues to move westward.
Mm-hmm.
Toward the island
of
Chincoteague.
It will always move westward. And you will always have a beach. That's the neat thing about barrier islands. storms come and go, and the history of the entire Assateague Island and the history of the entire Outer Banks of North Carolina is that after a storm, you may have an inlet, and it'll last for a while, but eventually it'll clog up, and another inlet will be created elsewhere. But there has never been a case of an entire island being wiped out. They've changed. And this one is on the move, especially down here. We, you know, this was identified back in the 70s. National Park Service commissioned a study by coastal geologists, and the south end of the island, right where the main parking lots are now,
that's Assateague Island.
Off Assateague Island, mm-hmm. was identified as highly erosional, and they identified on maps with the general management plan how they expected the beach to change by erosion. And those maps are absolutely correct. When I first came here, just north of what used to be parking lot number one there on the beach was a survey marker that was uncovered in one of the storms during my presence here. It was in the top of the dune, and it was put there following the 1962 storms, Ash Wednesday storm. And the sand dune eroded away. And this brass monument on a copper rod was standing about 5 feet in the air, right in the edge of the dune, and a year later it was in the edge of the surf, and within 2 years it was totally gone. The marker didn't move, the beach moved. Also in 1980, when I came here, on the south end of the island, there was a buoy, a red channel marker buoy, in the edge of the surf. And Jim Olin, the deputy at that time, pointed it out to me. Needless to say, hey, don't hit that buoy there. After all, it's only 10 feet wide, you know. Anyway, I couldn't help but miss it. By December, from September to December, that buoy was up on the beach. You could drive between the buoy and the water without getting wet. That buoy has not moved today. It is high in the island. The island has added that much to the south end. It's still there.
Amazing.
Yeah, amazing. Mm-hmm. So it's changing.
At the time that you were manager of this refuge, would you reflect on some of the more memorable characters during your tenure, either who visited or who worked for you, Denny?
Oh, boy. I have worked with some wonderful characters. And I think the older you get and the older they get, the more delightful they become. As an example, one of the employees we had down at Back Bay Refuge was an old waterman. He grew up on Back Bay, and in his earlier years, he was a guide, and they waterfowl hunting guide for a hunt club. And before sink boxes were outlawed, his name was Romy, R-O-M-I-E, Waterfield, and he used to guide for hunters from sink boxes. Well, sink boxes is a blind in the water that is sunk to the level of the water surface, and cast iron decoys are placed on the wings of the box, and big spreads of decoys. So ducks coming in don't detect anything unusual until it's too late, and then bam, they're dead. Romy was a self-taught person, and he had a school group with him one day on the beach, and one of the teachers asked, "Why do the tides come and go? Please explain that to us, Mr. Waterfield." And he was very quick on his feet, and he says, "Well, I'm sure that you all know that islands of the South Pacific are built on coral, and all of those coral reefs, he said, you know, those are living animals. Yes, yes. He said, well, they all breathe in at one time. That causes the tide to go down. When they breathe out, the tide comes up. And they accepted it, at least temporarily. But he was a wealth of different stories. And we had people here that, virtually the same. Some of the previous managers. One of the managers most revered was John Buckaloo. And John was the first real manager for the refuge. And he came in 1944, I think it was. And this area was, in terms of game laws, was somewhat lawless. And he and Cigar Daisy had not a confrontation as such, but Cigar got his name because John was trapping ducks for banding purposes, and Cigar used to beat him to the traps and empty his traps. And Sig was trying to get something for the pot or to sell. And at that time, Cigar smoked cigars, and he lost a bunch of his cigars in the trap one morning before daylight, and thought he had found them all, but he left one in there. Well, later that same day, John went in the barbershop, the Jester barbershop, and Sig was in there, and he says, well, here you are. And Sig was probably the only person that smoked that particular brand of cigar. And he says, there you are, Mr. Delbert Cigar Daisy. So Sig's had that name ever since, and he's quite proud of it. He said, yep, he outwitted John on that particular time. But John was probably one of the best in terms of getting the refuge truly established locally. Some of the others, Jake Valentine was another manager here, and Jake was a mountain man. As a matter of fact, there's a photo of him hanging in the corridors of honor at National Conservation Training Center and in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. A huge, I mean, a big man. He stood about 6'4", I guess, and at age 75, he still weighed maybe 185 pounds, lean, and, you know, he walked the mountains, everything. This marsh was home to him. He really genuinely loved it. And he knew biology backwards and forwards.
Have most managers been biologists, would you say? Or when did more formal training come to apply?
Oh, yeah. I got caught in that trap when I was applying for a job and when I first got out of college. Prior to 1960, I guess it was, education was not mandatory. That is, specialized education was not mandatory until civil service set up standards that required a certain level of biology, ecology, ornithology, you know, just a number of different zoo-type courses. Prior to that time, experience was a big factor. And after that time, then it became necessary. So today's employee, if you're in the Refuge Manager series, you will have to have X number of hours of biological background training. And that too is evolving, I'm sure, and I'm sure in time some of those requirements will be modified. Maybe probably more courses will be added into it. As I mentioned earlier, people management is probably one of the more important skills. Anyone can learn biology. anyone can learn some predictable behaviors of animals. Some people are much better at managing and handling people. Others can just irritate you by saying hello. And we all know some of those, don't we? They don't get elected very often, but what the heck, it does happen sometimes. But
will you tell us a little bit about your Father's Day? You come by this career naturally, sounds like. But what was it like in his day and when you lived?
I am a Depression baby, or I was. I'm no longer a baby, but at least I was born during the Depression years. And my dad was, at that particular time, he was working for the South Carolina Forestry Commission as a towerman. And so I was born at home in the South Carolina Forest Service watchtowerman's house at the foot of a fire tower. And Dad also was working with a fish and oyster company in Florence, South Carolina. And one of his younger brothers took the tower. I'll say manned the tower when fire conditions were such. And Dad was on the road. In 1939, Dad resigned and he quit his fish company job and took a much lower paying job for $100 a month at Carolina Sandhills National Wildlife Refuge in Macby, South Carolina. And it had just been activated. It was that's a long, complex issue too. But during the Depression years, one of the programs that President Roosevelt and the Congress instituted was the Resettlement Administration, where marginal lands were bought up and people were given lands and a house and a mule on something like 40 acres of land. So this sandhill country was bought up. Around 100,000 acres of it, and they said, well, what can we do with it? It'll make a wildlife refuge. Yeah, okay. So that's where it got started, and Dad was hired as a laborer patrolman. That was his title in 1939 at $100 a month and a house. We had a house. Didn't have electricity yet. We had an outhouse and a house.
And how far did it? How far away was school from the nearest town?
Well, the nearest town was about 4 miles away, and it was rural. And of course, the town of Macby itself was rural. My heavens, there was only about 400 people in this whole big area, enormous area. We did have a school bus, and the school bus route was something like 70 miles, and. And we were, thank God we were at the tail end of it, but that genuinely was a real experience. And Dad was there from 1939 until he transferred to Wheeler Refuge in North Alabama in 1942, in August of 1942. And we arrived at Wheeler on August the 21st, because that happened to be my birthday. And I remember that quite well. He was promoted. He was made assistant manager at Wheeler. And in 1943, he transferred back to Sandhills as the manager. Now, during the interim, a big part of the refuge was turned into an aerial bombing range and an aerial gunnery range for the pilots of World War II. So I was about 9 years old when we came back, and those rookie pilots and bombardiers, they couldn't hit the backside of, well, anyway, they missed the targets an awful lot and dropped bombs throughout the place and set fires all over. So believe it or not, at 9 and 10 years old, I was working on a fire line.
Ah, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, I reflect on a lot of these things that is just like, wow. A couple of months ago, here again, reflecting on things, we stopped at the visitor center at Wheeler Refuge in near Decatur, Alabama, and there's a drive that goes into the visitor center, and I asked one of the employees there, and I said, do you know where the name came from? And the name of that drive was Airport Drive. She says, I have no idea where that came from. And I said, right out in front here, during World War II, during 42 and 43, the Army Air Corps had a landing strip, and they were teaching pilots how to fly here. What? Very true. So, anyway, you know, these little bits of odds and ends pop up all over the place.
Have they got that whole land back now?
Oh, yeah.
And it's part of the refuge?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all of that occurred. And I ran across a report just recently that the Army contractor did for the Army on trying to determine unexploded ordnance and what types of ordnance was being used up there. We never had any injuries that we know of that occurred in that. Because, you know, with 96,000 to 100,000 acres there, you can string bombs all over the place. And, you know, hey, they get lost in there. They bury up and eventually will go maybe deteriorate. But they were practice bombs. They'd use a 10-pound black powder charge, but still that's enough to blow your head off if you fool with it.
Back to the Shinkatee Wildlife Refuge for a minute. How do you like the new Bateman Center?
That is something that I worked towards following in, here again, in J.C.'s footsteps. That was a mission that I had. It was shot down earlier by Committee to Preserve Assateague being the ring leader of it. And Mr. Apple, my predecessor, wanted to get a visitor center because the level of public use demands something of that size, and to at least tell the wildlife side what there's so much more to this refuge than that beach. The beach is only a small part of it, and the public should begin to get some appreciation for the salt marshes. Everybody sees salt marshes, but many people look at it as a breeding ground for mosquitoes. Well, good Lord, the web of life begins in your marshes. The plants, you know, soak up the nutrient loads that you get from sewage pollution, as an example. Yeah, phosphorus and nitrogens are recycled in that. The number of animals that start in the marsh, it is phenomenal. The public needs to begin to learn some of that. So, yes, the Bateman Center is something that we worked on. As a matter of fact, the very first monetary contribution was started when I was over there in 1986, when my son got killed. My son, Pat, had always reminded me of the great need for the public, because he was in direct contact with so many kids. Being out on the beach, he flew kites for Nafy Scarborough, and he did a little bit of everything, but he was in contact with a number of kids, and he was quite familiar with the wildlife and the marshes and the life cycles and chains, and so he was always talking about the need for the public to find out and know what's going on. So anyway, we set up a memorial fund instead of flowers to, you know, make a contribution. So the first money that was raised was $5,000 for the Bateman Center, and that started in 1986. And he gets a little mention on the bronze plaque over there.
You mentioned the Committee to Preserve Acetate.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember Judy Johnson?
Oh, how can I forget Judy Johnson?
Tell a little bit about that committee and what it did.
Well, I was also a little bit irritated because they presumed to want to run more of the not only the refuge but also national parks business than was due them, and so they dictated policy for quite a while. And it also, at the very end, it got extremely personal. She and I got along pretty good until the bitter end, and she went into a pretty vicious attack on me personally and my wife. And so I can't say that I'm one of her admirers now. I do admire much of the stuff that she represented in moderation, but it got quite extreme.
Do I remember correctly that there was a road proposed to go down Assateague, and that she had quite a role in preventing
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm. All right. The very initial legislation goes back to September of 1965. Authorized a number of different things. And in terms of legislation, the chief sponsor was Roger C.B. Morton, and Stuart Udall was Secretary of the Interior under the Kennedy administration, and Secretary Udall is the one that really advocated national seashore status for the whole thing. Congressman Morton, who was later Secretary of the Interior, got on board sponsoring the legislation, and they had to do a number of deals to make it acceptable. One of them was to authorize a road from one end to the other. A bridge at the north end, of course, was authorized. And commercial development at the south end. A hotel, da-da-da-da, without getting into any main specifics. But all of that was authorized in the original legislation. As you know, legislation takes many different forms to get passed initially. Let it rest for a little while, and then start attacking the rough points. And this is what Judy did. The road and the commercial development were taken out in by amendment in I don't know, 69 or 70, somewhere like that, perhaps. It was removed. So it was no longer authorized. And yet some people to this day will remind you that there's supposed to be commercial development occurring on the south end. That was true in the original, but not in the amendments that passed later.
What is your feeling about the old Coast Guard station that's been brought up recently?
It's a piece of history, and what do you do with the history? Can you utilize it? How can it be utilized? Is it worth preserving? I can't answer that. I can't make that decision. I could say that my own opinion is that it's standing there doing nothing, and let Park Service continue to use it for storage or whatever, but I wouldn't waste a heck of a lot of money on trying to maintain it.
Do you think it's in a fragile area?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure do. Why don't you look at moving it? Can it be transported out of there on a barge and brought over here? I would hope so. So get it over here in safer territory. Assateague Village, which is right over there, when it was, I'm trying to recall the some of the stories I've heard on Assateague Village, but when the south end of Chincoteague was bought, a number of houses were down near what used to be our boathouse, refuge boathouse, and many of them were loaded on barges and moved over here to the island. There used to be light keeper's quarters up near where the present house, White House, is. And it was, as I understand, a three-story structure. And it was taken apart, or not necessarily taken apart, but taken, cut in different sections, brought over to Chincoteague on barges and reassembled. So, you know, anything's possible. Even in the earlier days, things like that were done. So there's no reason why this old Coast Guard station couldn't be removed.
There is a lot of moving of houses.
Yes.
Small buildings on this island.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.